it's in there. It's in the record. So.
That's his other clock.
So I think we're ready.
How we doing?
It's one of those days.
Okay. Good afternoon. Call the Senate Judiciary Committee to order. We are in the Policy Committee this afternoon. Take up Senate File 164, Senator Champion's bill. Senator Champion, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the committee, and I know it's always difficult to have a hearing right after lunch, so I understand. So I'm going to try to be brief and get straight to the point. Mr. Chair, Senate File 164 is before you, and this particular bill is the product of the Governor's Elections Integrity Task Force and contains certain voter registration provisions and elections administrative procedures for individuals who have been convicted of a felony. Just for clarity, because I sincerely understand that sometimes whenever people hear felons and voting, they sometimes want to make sure that we are not doing something with the law at this particular time that they may not want done. And just for clarity, this bill does not change state law around when a person convicted of a felony is allowed to vote under Minnesota Statute 609.165. As you know, that our current law allows a person, once they are off probation or parole, or they're off paper, that's what some people say, that they once they've been released from that, that they are allowed to vote under the law. That civil right is automatically restored to them. The only civil right that is not restored to them at that particular time affirmatively is the right to possess a firearm. But again, just so that you're clear, that this particular bill that's before you does not attempt to change that law at all. But what is important is that this bill before you is the result of work by a bipartisan group, and that group, again, was the Governor's Elections Integrity Task Force. And, of course, you can see from this bill there's a cross-section of people who signed on. So please welcome, Mr. Chair, the co-chair of the Governor's Elections Integrity Task Force, Joe Nunes, to the committee, and he'll go through the bill.
Thank you. Senator, before we do that, you have an author's amendment to this bill?
Yes, sir. That would be...
Is that the A2 amendment?
Yes, sir, around data practices. Yes. Yes, sir.
Okay. Senator Goodwin moves the A2 amendment as an author's amendment. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. I will also note that we do have a quorum present. We did before that vote took place.
Thank you.
Mr. Nunes, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead with your testimony.
Well, thank you. It's a privilege to be here. It was a privilege to serve on the Governor's Election Integrity Task Force. To highlight the task force a little bit, it had a cross-section of what I would consider election professionals. I am not an election professional. I'm a private citizen. There are appointees from the associations of cities, of townships, of counties, the state court administrator, someone from the corrections department, someone from the county attorneys association, the secretary of state, the four legislators, Senators Stephen and Chamberlain, and the two representatives, Bob Benson and Simon, and myself. We were charged with developing a protocol to be used to inform people on probation of their voting rights or their rights not to vote or register. We were charged to improve the timeliness and accuracy of reports to the Secretary of State to be used in elections as to felons and people on probation, and to propose some modernizations to the state elections system while protecting the fundamental right to vote. So our initial focus really was understanding the law and processes in Minnesota, understanding the challenges and expenses in investigating and enforcing those laws, and the technological capabilities and limitations in our voting system. What we concluded was that our current laws regarding felon voting are complicated, unclear, and poorly understood. There was certainly support in the task force for the what we call the North Dakota model, which is simply an incarcerated, non-incarcerated voting right. We determined that there was undue pressure on county attorneys under Minnesota law and difficulties with respect to proof in challenging or prosecuting felons or potential prosecutions. We determined there is needed more data sharing with the Secretary of State's office and election professionals across Minnesota. And we determined that there were certainly technological improvements that would allow for modernization. So what you have here in this bill, as Senator Champion suggested, is not the North Dakota model. This is improvements and technical corrections to Minnesota law with respect to felon voting. You would think that it would be fairly simple, but it is not as far as current Minnesota law. For a felon, someone who's been convicted of a felony, to understand whether or not they are able to vote. It is unclear for many of them, and in fact, anecdotally, we heard people tell us that their defense attorneys sometimes gave them incorrect information as to whether or not they could register or vote during elections. So Section 1 establishes an administrative procedure for cases in which someone is believed to be ineligible to vote, submits a voter registration application, currently by itself a felony under Minnesota law, and allowing the county auditor basically to push back, give them notice that they're not going to process this application without further action on the part of the applicant. And current law requires that all registration applications must be processed. So again, you have the problem with a someone who is not, or who is considered a felon, not yet released from probation, who inadvertently or in good faith provides a registration, and that by itself is a felony. Section 2 provides an affirmative defense, again, sort of along the same lines, allows to have a request to have their voter registration withdrawn, provided they obviously haven't voted. Sections 3 and 7 are two different sections really involving the presentation of databases to the Secretary of State's office, and I believe that the amendment clarifies that those are private. Currently, the only database that exists, to my knowledge, again, I'm not an expert at this, but my understanding is the only database that exists is the Department of Corrections statewide supervision system database, which I do not believe is fully available to the Secretary of State's office. And again, this bill indicates that data may only be used as explicitly authorized, and it is private. It also requires the Secretary of State to provide a written notice to felons prior to each state general election, which they would be able to do with this enhanced database that would include last known addresses. Section 4 moves the responsibility for investigating voting violations from county attorneys to law enforcement. Currently, and I believe this is the only law in the Minnesota statutes, the county attorneys are required to investigate and prosecute any alleged voting violations. They don't really have prosecutorial discretion on it. They must do so under state law. This bill removes that and moves this over to law enforcement. Section 5 prohibits sending and delivery of absentee ballots to anyone who provides address of a facility where that only contains felony-only offenders. Section 6 provides that the signature on our voting roster at a polling place is legally sufficient evidence of an intent to vote. One of the problems with prosecuting felon voters, even if you have a signature at a voting place, it is a law of intent to vote. And so the prosecutors are presented with a problem of proving that this felon actually voted. Simply signing their name on a voting roster isn't necessarily sufficient. And finally, Section 8 requires the probation agreements for felony-level offenses include written notice that the individual is prohibited from voting. What the task force found through evidence is that there are, although there are a number of different places in our system where we can highlight the fact that a felon is not able to vote or to register, there is no concerted effort to make sure that that happens. And so what we're asking for, and some of these changes that we've requested of the judiciary and corrections are not necessarily required by legislation, but, you know, for instance, having judges in their orders make sure that from the bench that they advise felons that they, you know, remind them of their voting requirements and the disenfranchisement. Same thing with probation officers who use probation agreements and templates, if we could have that language inserted in the templates.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Nunes, is it?
Nunes, yep.
Nunes. We have, just as a matter of timing here, we have another five witnesses on this bill scheduled, so if we could have people keep it to about two or three minutes, that would be very helpful to move the committee along. The next person we have for witness is Jeff Narebrook. Please state your full name, and then when you're finished, please sign the board there so we know who was here.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Welcome.
I'm Jeff Narebrook. I'm with the Minnesota Council of Nonprofits. We're a statewide association of nonprofit organizations. I'm also here from the Voting Rights Coalition. We're a group of nonprofit and labor organizations that work on kind of strengthening and improving our election laws. Under the status quo of our current laws, we do see Senate File 164 as a needed change, and we're grateful for the efforts being made to improve the notification process and reducing penalties for people who have mistakenly registered to vote. You know, nonprofits have a unique perspective on this. Many of our organizations are the people who are assisting former offenders in all sorts of things, with health care, mental health services, employment services, housing, things like that. And during every election cycle, I inevitably get calls from nonprofit staff members who are doing voter registration. A lot of organizations are actually required by their contracts and grants with the state to provide voter registration. And they'll have somebody there who's had a criminal conviction, and neither the staff person or the person in the situation really knows what to do. We don't want the staff to be in a position of encouraging people to vote when they're not allowed to. We don't want them to be in a position of discouraging people who are eligible. So sometimes even calls to a parole officer doesn't clear things up, even though, you know, you'd think that it would. So it's clear that much work remains to be done to explain the current law to people that are in that situation, and certainly reducing the penalties for mistakenly registering we think is a very positive thing. However, we also ask you to take a step back as you're looking at this as a solution and do some conversation around the North Dakota model, which you've heard a little bit about. Which is, unless you're incarcerated, you can vote. The Governor's Election Task Force, as you heard, did look at it extensively. They did recommend that the legislature include it in its discussions. Some of the benefits they found include disenfranchising fewer people. It's a more easy law to be understood by citizens, by election officials, by people in that situation. It eliminates some of the administrative and prosecutorial costs and oversight, and it avoids the cost of implementing new systems, such as the ones we're considering. I think there's also the fact that prohibiting the right to vote isn't a very fitting punishment unless your crime was around election fraud. It's not a good retributive measure. It doesn't deter people from commission of future crimes. There's really no evidence of that. I think some people think it may make sense to, you know, you don't want to let people who have disregarded our laws and our society to maybe have an equal voice at the ballot box as people who have. And, you know, in that sense, you could say disenfranchises people who follow the law. I understand that sentiment, but I think it misses the whole point about voting, which is that voting is an inherently pro-social behavior. It's a responsible thing to do. It's a law-abiding act. And so I think people who make that solemn effort to wait in line on cold November days are, at least in part, indicating their regard for lawful, constructive behavior. I think that's something we want to see from people who who are coming back from prison. And that says something about where that person's at in their life, I would think. So let me just be clear that, you know, if we are to continue under the current status quo, we do urge you to support 164. We don't want to undermine making the system that we have better. But we do want to prod you to consider the North Dakota model. We think it is a better solution, and that this problem-solving, you know, activity that we're engaged in will suffer if we don't take a serious look at that model as well. So I hope to be able to come back before this committee to discuss the North Dakota model and its merits more further. Mr. Chair, thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Narbrook. And you have to work on getting that bipartisan support that the governor wants and that we think is appropriate for election law changes. And
I understand,
we'll be happy
Mr.
to
Chair.
Welcome you back to the committee.
Excellent. Thank you.
Thank you.
Senator Champion, did you have anyone else specifically that you had brought along to testify?
It's my understanding that the committee was contacted by maybe five people who wanted to testify, and that would be okay.
Okay.
If we could have those folks
I'll
come forward.
I'll turn to those folks
Chair.
Now then. Thank you. Is Rob Stewart here? Mr. Stewart, come on forward. Please be sure to sign the sign-in sheet there and state your name for the record and give us your testimony, please.
Excuse me. My name is Robert Stewart. I am a PhD student at the University of Minnesota. As I sit before you, I can't help but think of how President Clinton famously declared that the United States was a country of the people, for the people, and by the people. In other words, a democracy such as ours only works when citizens like yourselves choose to participate in the democratic process through participating in representative government or through exercising the right to vote. For that reason, I sincerely appreciate the opportunity to come and speak to you today, because like 60,000 other Minnesotans, I am a felon living in the community, and I am prohibited from exercising my right to vote. Growing up in Owatonna, I was taught that the right to vote is not just an important, sacred right, but it's also an integral part of a person's civic duty. It is through voting where we not only determine our city council members, our state legislators, and our national leaders, but we also vote on local tax or school referenda and amendments to the state constitution. Initiatives that any taxpaying member of any community would likely find important as they impact all members of the community. As citizens, our vote is how we take part in these decisions and how we give our say in how the government is run and how the tax money is spent. And as our civic duty, voting is the most powerful but yet invisible symbol of membership in our respective communities. And I realize that the topic of this hearing is felon notification, but I would ask the members whether that should be the focus or whether the focus should really be on the negative impact on felon disenfranchisement. Here in Minnesota, due to our reliance on alternative sentencing measures like probation, we have the second lowest incarceration rate in the United States, and I think that's certainly admirable. However, Minnesota also has one of the highest numbers of people on probation who are living in the community. As probation sentences in Minnesota have gotten longer, those numbers of people living in the community continue to grow rapidly because courts are regularly handing out probation sentences of 10, 20, or even 30 years. In other words, this is not an insignificant number of our friends, family, coworkers, and neighbors. But imagine that for a moment. Imagine being placed on probation for 30 years. The next presidential election you'd be eligible to vote in would be in 2044. Since my own felony conviction, I've worked hard to turn my life around. I've earned my bachelor's degree, graduating with honors, and I'm on my way to earning my PhD. I volunteer in the community. I work full-time, and I contribute to the economy and pay taxes. But I'm not allowed to have any say in how that tax money is spent. I want to participate positively and meaningfully in my community, but I'm not allowed to do so. As each election approaches, I am relegated to the sidelines. Social conversations become consumed with which candidates people are voting for, but I'm forced to admit that I'm not allowed to vote. A recurring reminder of my past mistakes. And it's tough. It's demoralizing having to sit home on election day, especially when each election can mean so much. Last November's election in Minnesota, I think, was a perfect example. And I'm not alone in my desire to be able to vote. Many friends and acquaintances in similar situations and circumstances feel the same as I do. We've made our mistakes in the past, but now many of us are positive and productive members of our communities. and we would just like to be full members of the community, of society, and not second-class citizens. And these feelings are confirmed by current criminological research that shows that voting discourages and decreases recidivism and serves as an aid in reintegrating individuals back into the community into positive and productive roles. And this is all free. It doesn't cost anything. So ladies and gentlemen, like I previously said, more than 60,000 Minnesotans are currently living in the community and disenfranchised. And that number grows every day. But instead of focusing on how we can maintain barriers that discourage an individual's reintegration into the community, I ask the members to focus on what we can do to encourage reintegration and membership for these Minnesotans. I hope that the members of this committee and your colleagues in the legislature will actually take a serious look this year at felon reenfranchisement and the positive impact that it could have for Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Stewart. What are you studying? What are you getting your degree in?
Sociology.
Terrific. Well, congratulations on your success.
Thank you.
Chair, any questions? Senator Limerick.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. sir, you made mention of studies show an increase of recidivism if voting is not allowed. Could you tell me what studies those are?
No, actually, the studies show that there's a decrease in recidivism where voting is allowed. So, because when if you frame it the other way, there is a study by Chris Eugen at the University of Minnesota. Chris Eugen, Jeff Manza, and I believe Angela Behrens, called Civic Reintegration. I don't have it off the top of my head, but I could get it to you.
So if you would provide it to the to the committee, we'd
absolutely
appreciate that.
There's other studies that are done by Robert Sampson and John Lobb, who also study dissistance. John Lobb, I believe, right now works for the Justice Department.
And Mr. Chair,
Senator Limmer,
you talked of felon disenfranchisement in your comments, but the way I understand the limits of this bill is that, and correct me if I'm wrong, I thought that this bill was not allowing felons to vote, but that this was a bill requiring notice to those that might be on paper or serving a sentence. And it's a reminder that they do not have the right to vote. It's a warning signal. Perhaps a signature or receipt is signed as a result of that, and that this bill does not allow felons to vote if they haven't commuted their sentence. I just want to make sure I heard that right in context with what you were talking about.
Yes. As far as my understanding, that's what the bill is about. The reason I chose to speak here today is because I feel like discussing this just on the level of felon notification, like the previous speaker said, is kind of missing something. We're missing a part of the conversation. I think that we also need to step back and take a look at this whole idea of felon disenfranchisement and understand, well, what are we really trying to accomplish, through disenfranchising so many people in Minnesota?
Mr. Chair, I'll hold my comments until later. Thank you.
All right. Any other questions for Mr. Stewart or comments on that? Thank you, Mr. Stewart. Jennifer Thomas. Thomas, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thanks for this opportunity to speak. I'm Jennifer Jewel Thomas, and I serve on the boards of two nonpartisan nonprofit organizations that are members with the Voting Rights Coalition. In addition, I serve as an election judge in Minneapolis, so I know firsthand how difficult it can be for election officials and citizens to determine the status of voting rights at the polls. Based on my volunteer work promoting accessible elections, I offer my qualified support of SF 164 because it successfully addresses some of the key issues with the current system. But my remarks today are also grounded in my 20-plus years of professional work as a marketing consultant. And based on this experience, I also urge you to support the North Dakota model of civil rights restoration because it addresses many of the inherent limitations of a notification system. Let me explain. My marketing work has included long-term projects with clients who are leaders in industries such where accurate, individual, customer communications are essential, such as financial management and healthcare. This has revealed the difficulties of maintaining current contact data, even with responsible adults who have investment accounts or who have committed to making a biological donation that could save another person's life. Despite compelling communications, these organizations must devote tremendous resources to maintain current contact information with their clients. And without this effort, the failure rate can be as high as 50%. One reason communications are so difficult is that Americans move frequently. The United States Postal Service reports that 17% of Americans change their address annually. That rate is much higher for the many Americans with unstable housing, including those with criminal convictions. This is what makes it extremely difficult to communicate personally with ex-prisoners after release from incarceration or probation. In addition, individual communications would be nearly impossible with those who've had their rights restored years ago, but don't understand that, part in part because of all the confusion about how it's handled and differences in other states. It's admirable to attempt these individual communications, but my professional experience confirms the challenges of notification that were indicated in the report of the Governor's Election Integrity Task Force. The best solution for managing voting rights status and communications is the North Dakota model, which is if you're incarcerated, you can't vote, and if you are out, you can vote. This model is the best for all concerned because it eliminates the significant cost to taxpayers of a notification system. It removes the distraction from public safety for county attorneys. It's easy for the administration for election officials. And it's more fair to those who could already be voting but don't know because they're are afraid to because of the confusion. And finally, it's better for the community because, this, as you heard from the last speaker, the civil act of voting is correlated with reduced recidivism as people try to get their lives back together. SF 164 has some important fixes. It should be retained. It's tempting to consider the communications part of this bill as a step in the right direction. But it would require the state to set up an expensive system with limited effectiveness. Why not go directly to the most promising solution, which would save money while optimally promoting democracy? This solution would be a win for all. I urge you to skip this notification Band-Aid and proceed directly to the North Dakota solution in which only incarcerated felons would be prohibited from voting, which would make communication so simple that individual contact would not be required. Thank you for your time, Chairman.
Thank you. Are there any questions from Ms. Thomas? Thank you. Please be sure to sign in the sign-in sheet that should be around there somewhere. Thank you. John Kingery. Mr. Kingery, welcome.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm testifying today on behalf of the Minnesota County Attorneys Association. We support Senate File 164, which came out of the governor's task force, which was mentioned earlier. We participated in that task force and were partially instrumental in getting the affirmative defense language put into Section 2 of the bill. As the others have said before me, and I'll be very brief, we're spending limited state and local resources to, quite frankly, build a better mousetrap. Most of these individuals that have voted felons illegally thought they could vote. This notice provision will certainly, hopefully, reduce those numbers, but quite frankly, as has been stated before me, the easiest, cleanest approach is to adopt the North Dakota model that would allow felons out of prison but still on probation to vote. And that is why last spring the Minnesota County Attorneys Association Board of Directors went on record as supporting the North Dakota model. We will be introducing legislation in the near future and certainly take your guidance, Mr. Chairman, to try to get bipartisan support for the bill. That's critical, and we will attempt to do that. The only recommendation, suggestion I would have to the bill would be in Section 4. It refers to the American Bar Association criminal justice section standards regarding the prosecution function. We would recommend, and I've talked to Senator Champion about it, to replace that with the language in accordance with the National District Attorneys Association National Prosecution Standards. It's a 300-page document that's been produced by the National District Attorneys Association. I shared information with Senate Counsel with regarding to the screening of offenses, complaints that come into the county attorney's office, the charging function, as well as the probable cause determination. Again, it's a 300-page document, lots of commentary in it. It's simply a document and a reference the prosecutors are more familiar with than the ABA standards. And with that, I would be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Mr. Kingery, other than the familiarity question, are there any substantive differences between the ABA standards and the National County Attorneys Association standards that you know?
Mr. Chairman, they're basically the same. The NDAA standards go into a lot more detail, and they provide a lot of commentary about what they mean. The ABA standards, from what I've seen, talk a lot about the Brady requirements and so forth that we all know as attorneys. But again, the NDAA standards go into a little bit more detail and provide much more commentary about what they mean by some of the standards that they've set up.
So it's your impression that they would be more helpful to prosecutors in determining how to proceed or whether to proceed with the case because of the detail and the commentary and the guidance they provide?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, yes, that's correct.
Senator Champion, what's your position with regard to Mr. Kingery's proposed amendment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would see that as a friendly amendment.
All right. Are there any questions or comments about the proposed amendment?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Limmer.
I was going to ask the same question regarding the original language. But on that reference, whether it's the Bar Association or the National District Attorneys Association, what are those standards that we're blindly going to put into law?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Limmer, quite frankly, our first reference would simply be to delete that requirement completely. But we know that's beyond the scope of this bill. We know there's not the bipartisan support to do that. As has been mentioned earlier, this is the only provision that I am aware of in state statute that requires an investigation and then requires a prosecution. There is no discretion at all. And failing its repeal, this, we believe, would be the best standard to meet that.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Limmer.
We often make references to associations or sometimes federal law, a chapter in federal law, or according to the HAVA Act or according to HIPAA, but we never get that very much more specific than that, and we don't make reference to the time frame on these references. So what might be a good reference now, in 10 years, how would anyone know what we're talking about? Because the association that we're referring to may have changed the rules altogether in 10 years. So I would be more comfortable if there was a reference to what these standards are and as of a certain date. That way, in the future, we certainly will be helping a court handle legislative intent and have a little bit more specificity regarding our writing of law.
You know, Senator Limmer, sometimes we make references in statute to the Internal Revenue Code and subsequent updates or language, something to that effect. Is that something that you'd be comfortable with? Identify this document and then...
Well, Mr. Chair, yes and maybe no. And the reason why I say no is that the IRS does change its rules from time to time. Does that mean that the state would want to change its intent? Or specifically, do they want to follow an original reference as of 2013 that this is what we really meant? Or are we going to fluctuate our law following the association after their national convention from year to year? I just don't know how to make it specific. And you're making a good reference in trying to close that gap. But simply because an association, a trade association, wants or changes their policy outlook and recommendations to a state, I don't know if we want to be in line with anything and everything they always do from year to year. So I'm just looking for a little pinpoint in time where we can tack it down and say, this is what we meant.
Well, Senator Limmer, there is a second edition which we have a copy of here, which we could include in there. So it does refer, we could make it refer to a specific set of guidelines right now, if you'd be more comfortable with that.
Could right now mean that it would be in this date, as of a certain date?
As of a certain date. Well, I think one thing you might be a little concerned about is cementing it too securely also. If the professionals in their consideration and process determine that there need to be some tweaks in how they recommend handling certain kinds of prosecution cases, I'm not sure that we want to have locked into our statute an outdated version of those standards also.
Mr. Chair, this is a good conversation. We lock everything into statute when we write a law. And we're making a reference. I don't know. As of today, I didn't even know there was a National District Attorneys Association that was countering the recommendations of an American Bar Association. So, and I still don't know which standards are the same or if they're different or if there's a slight tweak to them. I'm just looking for specificity, and I think that is a good thing. As of a certain period of time, that's the recommendations we're going to follow. I'm just looking for pinpointing it. If we want to, if it's the intent of the legislature to follow an association's recommendations from year to year to year, that means that that's going to change, and every time there's going to be a prosecution on this, that means that the prosecutor is going to have to look up this law, see what it's referenced to, and then track down the association and look at their most recent report to see if that's, and then the question of true legislative intent may be raised in a courtroom. Just all sorts of questions without being specific as we write law.
Mr. Kingery.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Limmer, you certainly raise good points. It always is awkward when you refer to an association, whether it's the Bar Association or the National District Attorneys Association. I could not agree more. And that's why, quite frankly, and it's beyond the scope of today, I understand that our preference would be just repeal Minnesota Statutes 201.275, period. Again, that is the only statute that I'm aware of that removes the discretion from prosecutors. It's the only one that I'm aware of. If, with regard to a particular point in time, the first edition of these standards was published in 1977. The reference that I make today is to the revised edition in 1991. These standards they stand the test of time, quite frankly. They don't change that often. And if you were interested in locking into a particular point in time, I guess I would just reference to the standards published in 1991.
Mr. Kingery, does the second edition accomplish the same thing?
Yes, sir. Mr. Chairman, yes, it would.
All right. The idea is to propose an amendment here that Senator Champion would like as a friendly amendment to the bill. Is there a motion?
So moved.
Senator Dietzick offers the amendment. I'm going to ask counsel to please read the amendment into the record.
Mr. Chair and members, the amendment would be on page 4, line 17, delete everything after the. So delete American Bar Association criminal justice section. And then on line 18, delete everything before the period and insert second edition of the National Prosecution Standards published by the National District Attorneys Association.
All right. All those in favor of the motion say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Anything further, Mr. Kingery?
No, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, and next time I testify, I'm hoping it's in support of the North Dakota model. Thank you.
Welcome the opportunity. Let's see here. Carrie Williams. Is Ms. Williams present? Okay. Is there any other Anyone else who wishes to be heard with regard to Senate File 164? All right, there being no further public testimony, is there any further discussion? Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I could bring our attention to page 1, line 12 of the bill. There's a reference to another public entity, and I was wondering if we could get a definition of what that public entity might be. Could it be any public entity? It seems like it's referring to a specific one, and I don't know if there's a definition.
Senator Champion or counsel, anyone know what if that's supposed to refer to anything specific or just any other public entity that's providing records?
Mr. Chair, at this particular time, I don't know what their specific intent was, but it appears to mean any other public entity that they believe would be helpful in ascertaining information around any particular individual.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Limmer.
I know there's some in the legislative body that really relies on government agencies to provide information, but does this mean that a private citizen, if they had information that they wanted to provide, would be barred from consideration? Because it seems specific that only a public entity can give this information and no one else. Is that what you intend?
Mr. Chair?
Senator Champion.
It would appear that it would be any other public entity as is written.
Mr. Chair, if an individual, let's say a family member or a neighbor, knew that a person had illegally registered, wanted to tell proper authorities, does that mean that they would be barred from that, passing that information to the proper county auditor?
Mr. Chair?
Senator Champion?
It is not my thinking that they would be barred, but I naturally assume, based on the articulation of the rhetoric there or the words there, that they would have to submit that to maybe another entity to be verified, could be the auditor, but I would naturally assume that if they want to report something like that, that they would go to the police or some other entity, and they would have the wherewithal by which to investigate that and then pass that verified information on to the necessary parties.
Senator Limmer, I think I would supplement that by suggesting that in the provision that we just amended on page 4, the law enforcement agency that is notified by affidavit, presumably from anyone, could be an individual, of an alleged violation would have to investigate that question. The paragraph on page 1 that you're looking at would result, because it's coming from records provided by another public entity, it would actually mandate that the county auditor notify the individual that they are not eligible and will not be registered to vote until that their eligibility is reaffirmed. So I'm not sure we'd want to cause that result simply on a verbal allegation by a neighbor or someone, but presumably if it's based on records from a public entity, that really calls into question their eligibility.
So, Mr. Chair, the way I understand the writing then is the county auditor is only limited to looking at things of record, and that if there was an accusation, let's say, from the public at large, the county auditor would not have, do they not have the tools to investigate, or would that be forwarded to a law enforcement agency to do that?
Sounds like, Senator Champion, it would be forwarded to the law enforcement agency. Is that correct?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
All right.
Satisfy your concerns, Senator Limmer? Any further questions or discussion on Senate File 164?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Limmer.
I know this is not the Finance Committee. I'm assuming this might go to Elections Committee and then probably return to us in the Finance Committee. Is that the way you see it, Mr. Chair?
Senator Limmer, we're informed the bill needs to go to Rules from here.
Right.
I'm not sure why or where it goes from there.
They want everything, Mr. Chair.
I suspect we might see it again with regard to the finance piece of it. But it looks like the pieces relating to finance, part of it is related to the Commissioner of Corrections, so we might see that again. Well, I guess we'll let rules decide.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, the reason why is that we're expecting certain responsibilities by the courts, certain responsibilities by the Department of Corrections. I'm sure that's going to trigger some finance charges in the area of our jurisdiction. So I was kind of curious of what the costs would be, but this is a policy committee, and we may not even know that yet. But I just wanted to have some assurance that it might be coming back to our finance.
Senator Limmer, I'm told that it's going to rules because elections is a subcommittee of rules. So it'll go back to the elections subcommittee, right, and then we'll pick up the finance piece later on. The finance references are on the bottom of page 6 in section 9, so it looks like the Secretary of State and the Department of Corrections at least will have a couple of finance pieces. Anything further?
Mr. Chair, one
Senator
more question.
Yes.
I'm sorry to keep doing this, but on
Senator
the going back to the A2 amendment that we passed, we make reference to private data. And are we making this, is this a new private data law, or is this something that is already in existence? And do we treat other vote records in the same similar manner as private data?
Senator Champion?
Mr. Chair, it is my understanding, and we could also get this clarified from Senate counsel, that we are not creating any new category, that this is consistent with other like information.
Ms. Pontius?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Senator Limmer. Yeah, the language of the bill as introduced wasn't entirely clear what it was doing. It stated that the Secretary of State may only use or disseminate the data as authorized under that section. So it seemed to imply that it meant that the data were private. So the amendment actually explicitly states that. A lot of this would be private under current law, like some of the corrections data, especially like personal information that's not related to the offender's status, the things like the addresses and whatnot would be private data. But this would, you know, restrict access to the lists and the database in this format. It would not affect the data in the hands of other entities like DOC or probation officers.
Mr. Chair, and counsel, that other information would be a criminal record, a felon record, correction record that might be already available to the public. So what we're doing is taking the more personal data, such as an address. Now, the only question I have is I suppose since we're not considering these people as legitimate voters at this time in their life, then we could protect their address, because a voter, you can get a voter list with everyone's address on it. I just want to make sure that we're categorizing the same for specific data privacy protection and not treating one as private and one as not. Am I getting that right?
Mr.
Senator
Chair.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Leonard. Yeah, this would just apply to this particular database, so it wouldn't affect the other sources of the data that are out there.
And just for clarity, Mr. Chair,
Senator,
it's something that Senator Limmer said that I would hope that I need to clarify. This particular bill makes sure that there's notification for individuals who have not been released from probation and any other supervision, but it also provides notice for individuals who have been released as well. So I just want to make sure that we're very clear about that, but the guiding principle is notification.
All right. And one last question.
Senator Limmer, your last question.
Mr. Chair, are you going to hold him to that? I'm not sure.
To the extent the chair has any power over Senator Limmer, yes.
I get the signal, gentlemen. But on page 2, on line 15, we make reference to the Help America Vote Act of 2002. And listed below that are the requirements under that section for HAVA. But we're now adding to that list, and I'm just wondering, is what's found on line 19 through 20, is that a new provision? Is that something that was part of the original 2002 HAVA Act, and we're now going back and adding it? Was it kept out of our law for some reason?
Mr. Chair?
Senator Champion.
It is my understanding that that's new, but again, Beth Fraser was here from the Secretary of State's office, but she's not here anymore. She had to go over to the House for another hearing, but it's my understanding that's new just because of the fact that we're adding in this other requirement that this list becomes available and that the list contains information on individuals who are currently on probation and as a result of being on felony probation, that's important to say, felony probation, that their civil rights have been lost.
Mr. Chair, is so.
Mr. Limmer, a follow-up.
So is subparagraph 2, is that part of the 2002 HAVA Act? Is that a correct reference then, if we're just adding it as new?
It is my understanding. Mr. Chair, that's my understanding. But again, I can stand corrected, but that's my understanding.
Okay. Senator Limmer, I understand where you're going, and you may have caught a reference issue, and I think maybe the easiest way to do it is to let the election subcommittee know that they might want to take a look at that cross-reference to make sure it fits in with the reference to the HAVA Act.
Mr. Chair, I'm on that committee. I'll be happy to make that reference.
I'm sure it'll be taken care of. Seeing no further questions or discussion, is there a motion?
I'll make the motion.
Senator Goodwin moves that Senate File 164 as amended be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Rules and Administration. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Champion.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, committee.
So we'll just leave it without the title.
Next, we'll take Senate File 33. Senator Latz. Welcome, Senator Latz.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I understand you have an amendment that you'd like to offer.
I do, yes. The A5 amendment is an author's amendment. I ask the committee to move the A5 amendment.
Would you like to explain the amendment, Senator Latz?
Sure. Madam Chair and members, the A5 amendment is a delete everything amendment, which does a couple of things. One is that it makes some adjustments in the text of the original main section of the bill relating to assigned consumer debt default judgments.
Thank you.
In addition to that, it adds provisions relating to revival the statute of limitations. It adds a provision relating to the question of being able to put someone in jail for civil contempt for failing to complete the financial disclosures relating to the default. We'll have testimony in detail on all of these provisions forthcoming.
Hey, Mr. Chair, Senator Latz. Do you just incorporate that, or are we voting on it?
We have to vote on it.
Never mind.
Sure.
This is the delete all amendment, 33A-5. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Amendment is adopted. Senator Latz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Many of you may remember, it was a couple of summers ago now that the Star Tribune had a series of articles in the newspaper detailing abuses in the collection of debt from persons, consumer debt essentially, such as credit card debt, in which sometimes debt was collected by very aggressive collection agencies, often debt buyers who had purchased the debt from the originator of the debt, often on pennies on the dollar, and then would use all sorts of tactics to try to collect on that debt. One of those tactics was to go in and get a default judgment, to sue it out in conciliation court, and to provide the minimum level of information necessary as a part of their filings in conciliation court. And the process was such that often judgments were obtained by default, meaning the person being sued, the person who supposedly owed the money, did not show up in court to contest it. There are issues relating to the volume of cases that were being used for this process, the ability of the courts to review the documents that were provided in substantiation of the debt, whether or not the documents that were provided in substantiation of the debt were adequate and actually did substantiate the debt. There are often questions raised about whether or not the person who was alleged to owe the debt was in fact the right person, or whether it was a different person with the same or similar name, whether in fact the amount that was being sought was an accurate amount, how much of that was the original debt, how much of that was fees and surcharges and other add-ons of one sort or another. So questions relating to the whether you had the proper defendant, whether you had the proper amount, and whether in fact you could even be in a court to collect that debt if it was beyond the statute of limitations. So there was an effort in the past to come up with a very broad consumer debt collection protection act, if you will, and that legislative effort did not proceed. But what you have before you today is a more limited, more narrowly focused proposal to help remedy the situation. And I will say that, there is a legitimate industry that is out there to hold people accountable for the debts that they owe but do not pay, and to collect on those debts either directly on behalf of the debt originator or when it's purchased debt to go ahead and collect on that. And the goal is not to eliminate that industry. The goal, however, is to put in place some appropriate regulations so that the debt is appropriately collected. And it's done so in a way that is fair and transparent and has all the trappings of due process that are appropriate in our economy and in our system. And so the Section 3 of the bill, I mean, I'll work off of the A5 amendment since it was to delete everything, that entitled Assigned Consumer Debt Default Judgments was a proposal of Attorney General Lori Swanson and was part of the original bill. And we will certainly go through that in detail, and I have a representative from Attorney General Swanson's office with me to do that. Section 2 of the A5 amendment addresses one of the other areas that was being abused. In particular, under current law, if the statute of limitations, which is 6 years on a consumer debt under current law, it also has a provision that statute can be revived, or you can sue after the 6 years if, after that six-year period of time, a consumer, a person who owes the debt, makes any kind of a payment on that debt. So you had situations where collectors would call them and without mentioning that the statute of limitations and their right to sue to collect had expired, would say, "We you owe us this money. Can you just make any kind of a payment whatsoever? We'll get you back onto a collection path. Even $10 will just help us get started." And in fact, yeah, it would help them get started. You send them the $10 and you revive the right to sue. And then all of a sudden they'd be in conciliation court and facing the lawsuit all over again when they didn't have any idea what their legal rights were in that regard. So that's Section 2. And then Section 4 addresses a situation which is sometimes referred to as debtor's prison, which many of us thought was eliminated in medieval days. People were imprisoned because they owed money, and of course they could never pay the money that they were that they owed if they were in prison. So they ended up being interminably in debtor's prison. And what you have under current law is a somewhat frequently used mechanism to collect the money by which, in the process of after getting a default judgment, the debt collector tries to get financial disclosure from the debtor so they can go ahead and garnish the bank accounts or levy on the bank accounts or garnish wages and so on. Failure to fill out that financial disclosure form is considered civil contempt of court. And under current law, one can be put in jail for civil contempt. So you'd have people that would be subject to a default judgment that may not even have, maybe it was a default because it was an old address. They never even knew there was a lawsuit going on. And then all of a sudden there's a formal request for financial disclosure. It's not completed. Maybe it didn't even get to the debtor. And all of a sudden, because it wasn't filled out, there's a warrant out for their arrest. And sometimes the judges would issue the warrant and set the bail at the exact amount of the debt that was claimed to be owed, the amount of the default judgment. And then essentially then the court is acting as the collection agency. And there are problems when people are getting arrested on warrants that they didn't know existed for debt they didn't know that they still owed or in amounts that they didn't believe were accurate. It raised all sorts of issues of abuse in the system. So this changes the law in that area to say that in the event that there is civil contempt for failure to complete the financial disclosure, it's punishable only by a fine, not by imprisonment. So it eliminates that issue. So I would like to ask Nate Brenneman from the Deputy Attorney General in General Lori Swanson's office to make a presentation in support of this bill.
Mr. Brenneman.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Senators, Senator Letts. Thank you. Again, my name is Nathan Brenneman. I'm a Deputy Attorney General at the Minnesota Attorney General's Office, and as a part of my duties there, I oversee the work that's done in that office.
Excuse me, Matt. Could you get a little closer to your mic?
Thank you.
Difficult to hear you.
I was saying I oversee the work that's done in that office on the debt buyer industry. And based on that experience, I think that this bill, Senate File 33, represents some much-needed changes to the process by which debt buyers come into court and get default judgments against debtors, and really some commonsensical changes. What the bill attempts to do is it focuses on debt buyers need to have, when they come to court in these default scenarios, they need to have proof that they have the right person, that they're suing the right person, that the amount of the debt is accurate, and evidence that they have standing, that they own the debt, that they have standing to sue on the debt. So I'd like to go through and explain that in a little more detail. These debt buyers, what they do is they buy very old debt, sometimes extremely old debt, from third-party or from creditors, I'm sorry, credit card companies, telecom companies, in some cases, utilities. And then they attempt to collect against debtors who owe that debt. When they purchase the debt, however, what they receive is very limited information about the debt. Typically, they don't, as a matter of course, get documentation about the debt, but what they get is an electronic portfolio with a single line item of data about the debt, and then they take that line item of data and they aggressively pursue the debtors for the debt. Well, aggressively pursuing debtors based on that limited information can cause some problems, as we've seen in the Attorney General's office. And the biggest problem that it can cause is that debt buyers sometimes go after the wrong person for the debt. Especially this happens with people with common names, is that they cast a wide net and they end up bringing in the wrong people. We had a gentleman that we got to know by the name of Daniel Fisher that this happened to. The first time he found out about a debt is when his credit card company contacted him and said, well, listen, we're lowering your credit limit because of this thing that appeared on your credit, this negative credit scoring that we became aware of. Well, lo and behold, he had been subject of a default judgment against him by a debt buyer for a debt that wasn't his, and he eventually got that cleared up after he contacted our office, but this is a situation that some Minnesotans find themselves in. And it's really an unfortunate one, because when a debt buyer comes calling about a debt and it's not your debt, debt buyers aren't easily persuaded to go away sometimes. And so Minnesotans are sometimes left in the position where they either need to hire an attorney and pay money to an attorney to get the problem solved, or, you know, they need to somehow deal with the debt buyer about this debt that is insisted that they owe. Another young woman that we met is Ka Yang, who is a bank teller at a local bank. She had been saving. She was set to be married and was saving money, and she suddenly received word that money had been seized by a debt buyer. Well, she'd never heard about that debt before. What had happened is that the debt buyer had come in and gotten a default judgment against Ka Yang on a debt. She'd never received notice of it, and it wasn't her debt. And she was in exactly the situation that I just described, where she went to the debt buyer, tried to work with them. This isn't my debt, but the debt buyer wouldn't listen, and so she needed to retain private counsel, and she needed to pay that private counsel about $2,000, which she never got back, in order to fight that debt. She got it cleared up. It wasn't her debt, so in the end, she got the debt off her record. But it's, again, another illustration of the problem that it can occur. And so this bill really gets at that problem by requiring some real commonsensical pieces of evidence that need to be brought forward by the debt buyer before they can get a default judgment against a debtor. And again, it focuses on three things. One, that they have the right person. They need to come forward with admissible evidence that they have the right person, that they're going after the right person for this debt before a judge enters judgment against a person. The second thing is the amount of the debt. They need to prove that they're suing the debtor for the correct amount, and they have to itemize for the judge the amount of the debt at the time of charge-off by the original creditor, and then any charges and fees that were added on to it. And then finally, there's this issue of chain and title. Sometimes these debts are bought and sold numerous times, not just from the original creditor to a debt buyer, but then to another debt buyer and another debt buyer and another debt buyer. This would require a debt buyer to show that chain of title, show that they have legal ownership of the debt such that they have standing to bring the suit and get a judgment from the court for default judgment. And I really think that this will help judges. I really think that judges are going to appreciate this information brought forward to them in a clear and concise way that's going to give them confidence to enter these judgments against Minnesotans. I know that we had a case against a debt buyer here recently where the debt buyer was improperly submitting affidavits to the court that were not proof of the debt. What they were robo-signed affidavits by employees of the debt buyer that really didn't prove anything. That's the sort of thing that they revert to now. But under this bill, I think it would really require them to come forward with some clear, concise evidence that would eliminate really this horrific circumstance that some Minnesotans find themselves in with regard to these debt buyers. So I appreciate that this committee has this under their consideration, and I'm happy to take any questions that they have.
Members, do you have any questions? Senator Ortman?
Chair, thank you. And Senator Less, thank you for bringing the issue to everyone's attention. It's there are lots of ways to go about this, though. And so I'm wondering, why did you choose this way? I mean, one of the ways might be to do attorney's fees for the wrongful identification and default judgment, because this seems like a very broad brush that would apply to all debtors and not just to the second or third hand buyers of debt. It would include all those legitimate creditors who have a claim in court. And so I'm wondering, why so broad? Are there more limited ways that you could address this? And we talked a little bit about it over the last couple of years. Raising the conciliation court limit also begins to address this, because there is no default judgment in conciliation court, and folks often get more information that way. So why this? Why this plan?
Senator Letts.
Senator Ortman, actually this is a more narrow approach to it than making attorney's fees available across the board, because this provision would apply only to default judgments. So if someone is going to go in and seek a default judgment, they have to prove up that they were entitled to that default judgment. If it's not going to end up in a default judgment situation, then you've got a party that responds to the summons and complaint, and everyone is held to the burdens of proof in the ordinary court proceedings. So to I'd say this is a more narrowly focused remedy than, say, assigning or allowing attorney's fees if something wasn't properly brought.
Madam Chair.
Senator Ortman.
I certainly am considering what you're saying, Senator Latz, but the numbers, perhaps Attorney Brenneman can talk about this, the numbers of cases that you're talking about trying to address here is a very small number compared to all the numbers of default judgments that go through our courts. And so you're creating a lot more work for all those other creditors. You're creating a lot more work for our courts. I'm not saying it's a bad thing. I'm just saying the numbers here of the folks you're trying to help are very small comparatively, are they not?
Oh, Mr. Brenneman.
Madam Chair, thank you. Senator Ortman, I appreciate that. I think that this bill is narrowly tailored to debt buyers. So the initial language is a party entitled to judgment by default and an action upon an assigned obligation. And so I don't think that this bill is going to affect original creditors who come in and attempt to collect against debtors. It's only going to be in the situation where the original creditor, whether it be a credit card company or a telecom company or a utility, sells that debt to a debt buyer, and that debt buyer then comes in as the named party to get a default judgment in a district court. And I think that it is, as Senator Latz also mentioned, it is tailored to default judgments as well. These are requirements that a debt buyer is going to have to satisfy when they are moving or applying or requesting a default judgment, whether in conciliation court or in district court. And so I think with those limitations, I'm not sure I've completely answered your question, but I think that it is fairly limited and doesn't extend to the types of creditors that you may be worried about. Thank you.
Madam Chair, one other question.
Senator Ortman.
The whole principle of reaffirming a debt, what you're saying is if what this bill would do is eliminate that principle in these types of cases, right? So reaffirming the debt would be 2 years down the road, you start making payments again. In Minnesota law, case law, that would be reaffirming that the debt is still owed because you're making a payment. And so I'm worried about your section two. Are you eliminating that principle altogether in these kinds of cases?
Senator Latz.
Senator Ortman, Section 2 applies only where the statute of limitations has already run. So it's a 6-year statute of limitations in Minnesota on consumer debt. So if you're in year 7 and you get a phone call and you're persuaded to send in a check for $10, you may not realize it, but you might just with that $10 then be reviving the legal right of the debt buyer to sue you for the whatever amount is already expired. So you may still owe the debt, but there's no legal right to collect it in the courts after the statute of limitations has expired, and it's an area of some abuse. So even if you sent in $1, let's say there's a debt of $5,000 sitting out there, might have started out as a $100 debt, but then you get interest and you get post-assignment charges and other surcharges and fees and everything else added up over the course of time, and there may be the claim is for $5,000. You send in $1, and all of a sudden you are opening yourself up to a lawsuit to collect that full $5,000. And there's something misleading about that and not respectful of the legal rights of the person whose statute of limitations has already expired, whether or not they legitimately owe the debt.
Madam Chair.
Senator Hartman.
Thank you. I'm just not sure. I mean, I'm going to give some thought to that, but I really do believe that if I owe a debt and I haven't made those payments for 2 years, but then I try and get back on schedule, I'm really acknowledging that debt in that subsequent payment, whether it's $1 or $10, I'm saying, yep, I do owe you, and I should be paying you. And so what you're saying now is anybody that acknowledges that debt again still has that original statute of limitations. And that's really a change in the way Minnesota law currently operates. I mean, it would be contrary in this group of cases to all of the other types of commercial transactions that still have that whole principle of acknowledging a debt.
Madam Chair, Senator Ortman, for some reason you keep using the year 2 years, and I'm not quite sure why, because the statute of limitations in Minnesota is 6 years on the collection of consumer debt. Part of the idea here, and the whole idea of a statute of limitations, is that after a certain period of time, whoever might be subject to a lawsuit can rest assured that they can't be sued, okay, no matter where you end up applying it. That's the whole theory of statutes of limitations. If this is in place, it will force debt buyers to move earlier in the process, maybe in year 4 instead of year 7, to try to get that debt collected. So if I'm in year 2 of a 6-year statute of limitations and I make a payment on it, am I reaffirming that I owe the debt? Yeah, perhaps, but it doesn't have any legal impact on the statute of limitations. But if after that statute of limitations has expired, has run, and the debt buyer can't sue me for it, and then they call me up and say, send us a buck, and then I send them a buck in good faith, and then they can turn around and sue me for the entire thing. They've essentially hoodwinked me into giving up my rights under state law of the statute of limitations. And that's what I'm saying is inappropriate, but it is a tactic that is commonly used.
Madam Chair, I don't doubt that it's commonly used. I have no confusion about the 2-year, 4-year. I was talking about a 2-year delay in my payment schedule as an example. I mean, this is one of the reasons why I worked so hard to have our entire statute of limitations, the default statute of limitations, reduced to 4 years, so that there would be more finality and it would help some of these consumer debtors understand how long they have to be subject to a lawsuit. But the opposite is true, too, if somebody reaffirms the debt. So, again, if I'm a debtor and I have a credit card amount that fits within the description of what you have here, I could reaffirm that debt, say, in year 5. I haven't made a payment for 3 years, but I tell the company, I'm going to make a payment. I promise to make my payments. And I make that payment, and I don't do anything more. The statute of limitations has run after 6 years, regardless of whether I started to reaffirm that debt again, and I worry about that. The creditor then has that problem as well. Do I file the lawsuit in the next few months when my debtor has just reaffirmed the debt? Now you may be forcing them to file that lawsuit in 5 years and 10 months, because the statute is going to run, even though you may have somebody who was out of work for a while and now is making payments in good faith. You're going to force them, are you not, to file that lawsuit in year 6, regardless of whether somebody's making a payment or not?
Madam Chair, Senator Ortman, yes, you would.
Madam Chair, I hope you'll consider that as this bill goes forward. I'm concerned about that provision.
Members, any other questions? We have more testimony on this bill?
Yeah, Madam Chair, Ron Elwood from Minnesota Legal Services wants to testify, and I think Joel Carlson may want to offer some comments as well.
Thank you. Mr. Elwood?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Ron Elwood with Legal Aid. I want to thank Senator Letts for bringing this bill forward. I think this bill focuses on ensuring that legitimately owed debts are the subject of judicial action, and while also protecting against the demonstrated problems that we've seen in this industry. I just want to relate one case that we have. We have many cases around involving collections and specifically debt buyers, and I think this case is illustrative of the benefits that this bill would provide. In one case, we had an attorney, a debt buyer case, and he took a deposition, one of our attorneys, from the company. And the employee explained the process that they have of proving up the debt. Sometimes the employee said that she did not have the original agreement, and so she would just go to the credit card company's website and just download a contract. And this is what she was taking to court and representing to the judge as the actual contract for the specific account. So, again, I want to support this bill and Senator Latz's efforts here and thank the committee for the time.
Thank you, Mr. Allwood. Would you please make sure and sign in? Do you want your next testifier, William Hicks? Is this
no.
The Creditors' Rights Association? But that doesn't look like Mr. Hicks. Is that Mr. Hicks? That looks like...
Madam Chairman.
Joel Carlson.
Madam Chairman and members, my name is Joel Carlson. I own a government affairs business here in St. Paul. And I represent a group called the Minnesota Creditors' Rights Association, which is an association of attorneys that represent creditors in court proceedings to collect what we believe are legitimately owed debts. And we, too, have been troubled about the stories that have been in the paper and, in fact, have been talking with Senator Latz for almost 2 years now to try and formalize the process for appropriately proving up the debtor, the amount of the debt, and the appropriate charges. So we appreciate the effort here. We do have some concerns about the language to make sure that it gets us where we need to go. And I think Derek Weber, who's one of the members of the association, is going to kind of walk through a couple of those issues. But, you know, we have long thought that this issue of a payment on the debt after the statute of limitations has run, you know, is unfair. And we've asked Senator Latz to fix that. And I think he had a bill to do that last session. I think Senate File 1440 that fix that. We do want to make sure the language is right, though. And what we were talking about, Senator Ortman, is you know, a payment on line 1.27, a payment on the account that is made after the statute of limitations has run. And I'm hearing something different from Senator Latz that he maybe wants to change that. But right now, the statute of limitations begins to run at the date of charge-off or within 30 days of default. And we certainly don't want to have someone make a payment 2 years down the road and have confusion that the statute of limitations was some other date beforehand. So we just want to make sure the language is right, not that we want to restart the statute of limitations every time there's a payment after the statute of limitations has run. And I'm going to let Mr. Weber talk about Section 3 of the bill, and we're happy to answer questions and appreciate talking with the Attorney General and the courts to make sure that we get this bill right for everyone. So,
Madam Chair, if I could ask a question before the next testifier. If I were the debtor and the statute of limitations has run, why would I make another payment?
Madam Chair, Senator Ortman, because you may not realize the statute of limitations has run, or even if you did, you may think that you can go ahead and make the payment, and the only consequence is that you've made a payment. You may not realize that you might then revive the statute.
Well, Madam Chair and Senator Latz, if I borrowed $10,000 and I strung out the payments, by the end of year six, I may still legitimately owe $4,000, but I'm not going to pay back that $4,000. I wouldn't have to because the statute of limitations has run and nobody's got a remedy against me, right?
I'm not sure that's correct, Madam Chair. We might want to ask counsel, or maybe Mr. Carlson has an idea.
Madam Chair and Senator Ortman, not as we understand it. Your statute of limitations begins to run at the date of default. So when you quit making your payments, the statute of limitations would begin to run, and then the statute of limitations is 6 years from that date. So it's the date of default. In your scenario, a default hasn't occurred. That's how I heard your scenario. I paid for so many years, and then I don't pay. It's that time at which you don't pay that the statute of limitations begin to run, the date of default.
Madam Chair, there wouldn't be a right to sue on the debt if you're making the payments in accordance with your contract. There's just no cause of action at that point. The only place a cause of action arises is when you violate the terms of your contract by which you borrowed the money. And then there's a contractual action, like don't make the payment, and then a statute of limitations might start to run. The 6-year clock would start to run at that point. So if you made all your payments for 6 years and then you skip the last payment at year 5 and 11 months, that's when you violated the contract, and your actual statute of limitations begins to run then. You have 6 years after that point to sue on the default.
Madam Chair.
Senator Hartman.
The language doesn't say that. It doesn't say that the statute begins to run upon the first default. If that's your intention, I think that should be more plain in the language here.
Madam Chair, Senator Ortman, the bill doesn't address at all when the statute of limitations begins. It's not an area that we're trying to remedy. The law is as the law is right now with regard to that. What we're saying is once the statute of limitations has started to run and it gets past the 6 years and then expires, that the debt can't be, the legal action can't be revived after that point. So we're not trying to change the law with regard to when the statute begins to run.
Madam Chair,
Senator
Letts, you're clearly more up to speed on this. I guess it was more of a question. Is the current law state that the statute begins to run upon default? Is that current law?
Yeah. Madam Chair, I mean, counsel can jump in any time here, but, your statute of limitations doesn't start to run until there's a cause of action that arises. And there's no cause of action until there's a breach of the contract.
Senator Letts, perhaps we can ask Ms. Hontius to...
Madam Chair, Senator Letts and Senator Ortman, I think, part of the confusion is that a lot of this is not in the statute. You're not going to look there and see this is when the cause of action accrues or starts running, so a lot of it is case law. But I think you're correct. There would have to be some kind of a breach or default in a contract that would then trigger the running of the statute of limitations. So the statute has, like, time periods, but it's not always that explicit in terms of what starts that time period running.
So. Thank you.
Ready? Senator Letts.
Madam Chair and Senators, thank you for having me and the opportunity to speak about this bill. My name is Derek Weber and not Bill Hicks. I'm a version of Mr. Hicks, but I do practice law with Bill and with both shareholders in the Messerly and Kramer law firm in the collections division. I have been practicing for 20 years. I did begin my practice for the first 8 years at a small boutique firm, and in fact had a case against Senator Ortman. So I'll just.
I don't remember, but thank you for saying that.
I frequently counsel consumers, and I assisted them with financial matters, including in filing bankruptcy. If that's funny. Currently, I'm in a collection role. I'm on the other side, and I think this. Uniquely testify about this bill, given my practice from both perspectives on this issue. I'm here as an officer of the Minnesota Creditors Rights Association. This is an association that we formed. I'm one of the founding members, and it's 50 lawyers from 20 different law firms who practice in this, and we're experts in this area. We are sympathetic to the concerns that this bill intends to address. We support this legislation regarding the requirements for obtaining default judgments in consumer cases. And assigned debt. We understand those the need for those to protect our consumers. We have been working with Senator Letts since 2010 to develop a bill that provides meaningful and clear reforms. In 2011, our association assisted in drafting a legislation that was sponsored by Senator Letts and Representative Smith, which was very similar to the bill that was there before you. We'd like to continue to be involved in this process and making this legislation work for our consumers and our courts, clients, and we believe that we need to be involved in this given our expertise. We do support the goals that are stated by the Attorney General, the goal of making sure that we have the correct consumer, the correct amount, and the correct plaintiff, and that there's adequate evidence, but also that there are limits on bench warrants and clarity on the statute. And in that regard, we have a language issue, but we'll work it out. I believe I heard Senator Letts say correctly that the intent was after the expiration of the statute of limitations, a repayment will not restart it. And we'll certainly work with Senator Letts to make sure that the language is clear, that it is the expiration and then not the – it's what's referred to as zombie debt. After the debt is gone – then there's a restarting after the fact, and that's what this was attempting to address. So appreciate your comments in that regard, and hopefully we can get that language worked out. Nothing good comes from some of the things that have been going on, and our clients don't benefit, and we as their lawyers don't benefit, courts don't benefit, and certainly the consumers do not. And we're aware of these abuses and concerns that are out there, and we're trying to address them. The concerns we have with the language of this bill centers on kind of the proper legal process to obtain default judgments. And specifically, we want to make sure, and we understand that the courts are also aware of this, that we don't want to have a hearing on every default judgment in these types of cases. And so we want to make sure that the evidence is accurate but not merely admissible. And our concern is that the bill, as it's written, will eliminate administrative defaults for the certain types. The reason we're concerned about that is the word admissible. And our understanding of the law and our understanding of what the courts interpret as law, the word admissible is something that has to be determined after an evidentiary hearing or during a trial, and that can only be done by a judge. And that is not something that a court administrator in an administrative default situation can determine. And so we're concerned about that. We're concerned that the bill references required serving a notice of hearing when no hearing is required. We often deal with our consumers, and one of the concerns we have is to make sure that we're not confusing. Quite honest with you, we don't deal with sophisticated people all the time, and when you say that there's a notice of hearing, then there is no hearing, that's confusing. And so we want to deal with some of those issues and try to work on the language on those. But we are in support of it. We just need to work on some language, and we hope that Senator Latz will be open to hearing some of those. In fact, we've provided Senator Latz with some proposed amendments, and hopefully they will remedy some of those issues. I do want to thank you for the opportunity to speak today, and we do look forward to working with Senator Latz as this bill moves forward and to make sure that our civil law processes contained in the bill are developed. We hope that we'll make sure that it addresses the matter, the issues, and in a manner that promotes clarity and certainty for all those concerned.
I don't think so.
Thank you, any questions that people may have.
Thank you, Mr. Weber. Any questions? Okay. Thank you, Mr. Weber and Mr. Carlson. If you please remember to sign in. Senator Latz. Looks like we have Scott Larson here.
Thank you, Madam Chair,
members. Mr. Larson.
My name is Scott Larson. My company is St. Clair Capital, and I am a debt buyer. Typically in the debt that our model desires is what's called second. So we're actually the third buyer. So what is here addresses some concerns, I think, that are very valid. We agree, frankly, with the premise of the bill that nobody should be sued for an amount they do not owe, whether in part or in whole. So the concerns that are here are fine. Now we have to address, how do we solve the problem? I think one of the issues and one of the things I want to discuss is the documentation that's required. On line 1.16 of the bill, it reads, including an itemization of the balance owed at the time the debt was first assigned. The concern with this is, how will that then be interpreted by the court? Does that mean if somebody's had a card for 6 or 7 years and the bad times came upon them and they defaulted, now we have to prove up they had a purchase?
Excuse me one moment. I'd like to correct up so the committee knows it's on 2.9 in the new deleted all amendment.
My apologies.
Thank you. Please proceed.
My apologies. The concern that I have is, how will the court determine this statement? Are they going to go back and say, well, geez, do you have the itemization that they bought at Home Depot 5 years ago? So in relationship to that particular clause, I would like to simply suggest to the author and to the members of the committee that we delete the term itemization and replace it in that sentence with a statement, would it say, including an original creditor account statement. That statement at the time of assignment. We'll give you the amount. We'll give you the interest rate. We'll give you the account number, the debtor's name, the debtor's address, and all of the pertinent information. If, in fact, the committee has a difficulty with the number that's on there, I suggest to you this isn't a debt buyer legislation problem, but rather a banking problem. And that should be addressed through the banks, because that statement's going to tell you very clearly what's owed, that the bank has now made the statement. And I hope that that makes some sense. As far as the rest of the content of the bill, terms and conditions, much of this is done over the internet or the phone. So contracts are not readily available. Some applications are, but according to federal regulations, banking and Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, banks only have to retain these documents for 2 to 3 years. So in my case, I may be purchasing this debt 3 years out. So as a consequence to that, we sit in a position where it may not be there, but statements most logically are false statements. So it does potentially give you all that information. You can get a copy from the originating bank of the terms and conditions of the debt. It won't be the actual application or contract that the debtor, he or she signed or agreed to. So from that standpoint, if we center the number on the statement number and we are unable to get that document for any ancillary charges of late fees or over-the-limit fees, et cetera, we do know what the interest rate is from that statement. We do know what the balance is. So that statement should be sufficient evidence to the court that this is what's due and owing. And I think most debt buyers, while we would not be jumping up and down, that we wouldn't be able to get additional interest and fees, but we are purchasing it on the basis of the defaulted amount. So I think that that at least solves that, because we now have a basis, a number, that is now the final document, evidence certain, that says that that statement at the time of default or at the time of assignment is the number. And I thank you very much. That's for any questions if you have them.
Any questions from members? Seeing no questions, Senator Latz.
Madam Chair, Mr. Brenneman can respond to the suggestion.
Well, just with regard to the proposed language by Mr. Larson, I have been speaking Mr. Larson about this issue, and I don't think that clarification is needed, and maybe it'll help him to hear me say this to the committee, but the intent of the bill in Subdivision 3 is to have admissible evidence about the amount owed. As I said before, we're looking for three things: the right person, the amount owed, and ownership of the debt, and this one gets to the amount owed. And that includes an itemization of three things. One is the balance owed at the time the debt was first assigned to another party, a breakdown of post-assignment fees, interest, and interest rates. And so, as I understand Mr. Larson's concern, it's that he doesn't want to have to give a breakdown of the creditor, how much of the creditor's debt before it was sold is original debt amount, fees, interest, and so on. And that isn't what the language says in my mind, and it isn't what the intent of the drafting of Subdivision 3. So I don't think that the language is needed. And, in fact, I think the language raises a lot more. It's not just a clarification, but it raises a lot more concerns than it solves in terms of to the extent I've been able to consider it at all. So it's the position of the Attorney General's office that the bill be passed through as is. I'm happy to continue to talk to Mr. Larson if he still has concerns after that explanation after this hearing. But that's the position of the office on that point.
So, Senator Latz and Mr. Brenneman, so what you're basically saying is that you're not asking for an itemization of the of the purchase. You're asking for an itemization at the time the debt was first assigned, and another party by the originator, because you're trying to find out what the interest and fees have already been, so you can figure out, you know, what the original debt was compared to what all of the additional fees and interest were.
Yes, Madam Chair, the idea is to know what it was the original creditor wanted at the time the debt was first assigned. Then after assignment on line 2.10, post-assignment, fees, interest, and interest rates are a separate item. But pre-assignment, that's not required.
That's right. That wasn't the intent of the drafting. And, Madam Chair, what happens on these debts post-assignment is that interest and fees continue to accrue. And what we want the debtor to be able to understand is both the amount of the debt at the time of default with the original creditor, and then an itemization of all charges and fees that are added on by the debt buyer or multiple debt buyers in some cases. And so that's what we're looking for on that section. And I think that's what the language achieves, and so I think we're all square with that.
Thank you, Mr. Brenneman.
Madam Chair, I do have, in light of an earlier comment that was made with regard to the statute of limitations, I'd like to 2.6 to provide some clarification. After the period, insert after its expiration, comma, so it makes clear that, as I have described the intent, the question of not being able to revive the statute of limitations is when a payment is made after the expiration of the statute of limitations.
So Senator Latz wants to amend 1.26 to say,
Madam Chair, members, yeah, a couple of things. After its expiration, comma, would be before the. And I'm also wondering if you'd want to take out the reference to tolls now, because tolling happens during the statute of limitations. So just say, after its expiration, the statute of limitations is not revived by the collection.
Ms. Pontius, could you explain what the tolling vision is, because I was trying to get some clarification on the original language as well on that. Mr. Brenneman maybe can. I'll ask Mr. Elwood to address that, if I may.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my understanding is that in certain cases, The statute of limitations can be essentially stopped. The clock stops. That's what tolling means. So I think actually Ms. Pontius's suggestion makes sense, because once the statute of limitations has expired, it can't be stopped and restarted. And I think this gets exactly at what Senator Latz's idea was. And I think Senator Ortman's clarification or discussion on this makes a lot of sense.
Senator Latz, do you agree?
Okay. Yes.
So we will change the amendment to say,
Madam Chair, members, on page 1, line 26, after the period, insert after its expiration, comma, and then also delete or told.
Everybody understand the amendment? Okay. All in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed?
Freeze it. It's done.
Okay.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Thank
Senator
you.
Ortman.
Maybe this is a question for counsel. If we're not changing the statute of limitations from current law, is the first sentence needed in Section 2?
Madam Chair, Senator Ortman, I kind of had that question myself, because the six-year statute of limitations is there, and this is still a six-year. The really operative language is the second sentence, but I'm open to a discussion on that or an explanation.
Madam Chair and Senator Ortman, you know, this actually had been part of some negotiated language that we were working on with Mr. Carlson and his group in 2010, and that section actually, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, came from them to make it clear that 6 years is 6 years. And the reason that they, I think they wanted it in there, they can speak for themselves, but different state, you know, the credit cards are issued from different states. The contracts are all over the place. The laws that govern these contracts are from all over the states, and various states have different statutes. Some are three. Senator Ortman, you wanted to make it four a couple of years ago here. That's similar in other states. And so my understanding of what that was intended to do was to make it crystal clear that in these cases, 6 years in Minnesota is the number. And am I correct, Mr. Carlson?
I'm sure Mr. Carlson has something to add as well.
I couldn't have said it better myself. That's, it's
thank
absolutely
you.
Right. We want Minnesota law to apply to Minnesota consumers.
All right. Thank you. Well,
Madam Chair, for purposes of any kind of legislative history, I just want to make sure nobody here wants to change the current law application of the statute of limitations at 6 years. Because I think you could read in here that somebody's intending some kind of a change here, and that's not what you're intending, correct?
Madam Chair and Senator Ortman, that is absolutely correct. If the current statute of limitations, which is in a different section of law, says six years. So I think the intent here was to make it clear that with assigned debts are 6 years is six years is 6 years is 6 years in Minnesota.
Thank you. Anyone else in the audience that's going to speak in favor or against it? No? Then I guess members' questions. Senator Ortman.
Madam Chair, thank you. I appreciate your patience on working with me on this bill. I wanted to go back to the comment about admissible evidence, which I also think is a troubling standard. I'm wondering, are you intending that the court administrator, the clerk, the judge will actually be looking at this evidence to determine if it's admissible in a court of law and making a decision about that?
Madam Chair, Senator Ortman, thanks for that question. No, it won't be up to court administrators to determine what's admissible evidence or not. Admissible evidence, what we want in these cases and why we use that term is that we want good quality evidence of the three things I mentioned before, that they have the right person, that the debt buyers have the correct amount of the debt, and that they own the debt, that the chain of title establishing ownership is solid. Now, a lot of these default judgments happen in court, but many of them do happen administratively, especially in the metro counties here. And it doesn't require a hearing. This bill is not, the intent of this bill is not to require a hearing now for all default judgments. These can still be handled administratively. And it won't be up to the court administrator to determine admissible evidence. The way I envision this working is that the judges will be involved in determining what evidence is acceptable to them on administrative default judgments and doing some training of their administrative staff. But once they do that training, then that administrative staff will know what to look for in terms of the evidence that are going to establish these three things. But to your point, the point that was raised earlier, it's not going to require evidence to actually be admitted. Admissible evidence isn't admitted evidence. It's just evidence that's of a certain quality that it would be admissible in a court of law. Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Thank you. Senator Ortman.
I'm not trying to cause trouble, but is the decision appealable? I mean, what happens if I'm one of those creditors and the judge doesn't like my evidence because he or she decides it's not admissible for whatever reason or doesn't fit the standard here? Do I have a right of appeal?
Sure. Debt buyers have a right of appeal against adverse judgments.
Madam Chair,
Senator
specifically
Ortman.
With respect to these provisions, I would have a right of appeal to the Court of Appeals?
Sure. You could argue to the Court of Appeals on appeal. A debt buyer could that the district court misapplied the law, that I had such and such evidence that I presented to the district court, and I believe it was sufficient evidence to meet these statutory standards, and the district court found otherwise. And the Court of Appeals could, under those circumstances, take a look at the statute and overturn the district court's judgment. I can imagine that happening.
Madam Chair.
Senator Ortman?
Have you considered any other option, perhaps like a trial on the evidence in the district court?
Well, as I said before, I mean, in many cases, these do go to default motion hearing, and in those circumstances, we would want the court to look at what the debt buyer has that establishes these different requirements under the statute. Now, that's not exactly trial, but you have to remember these target default judgment motions in which the defendant is not appearing, and so it's just up to the debt buyer to outline for the court why it's entitled to default judgment by establishing these different factors. So I don't know that I entirely understand the question. I hope I addressed it a little bit, but we would. The intent is to have the debt buyer come forward with evidence of these factors and submit it with its default judgment motion.
Madam Chair,
Senator Ortman.
But the judge would always have the option, correct, to say, "Well, let's have a trial on the evidence." If they don't like the particular evidence submitted, the judge could always inquire further and have further proceedings on the evidence supporting the debt.
Yes, and it does happen right now, in fact, where debt buyers come into court for default judgments with certain evidence, and a judge takes a look at it and says, this is not enough for me. I'd like more evidence, in which case the debt buyer comes back with more evidence. That does happen already. The point of this legislation and this bill is to set some standards for what a debt buyer needs to come forward with in the first instance that I think will help courts get the evidence they need right at the outset.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Any more statements?
I have nothing further, Madam Chair.
Glass.
Madam Chair.
If there's nothing further, I'd like to make my motion.
Oh. Okay.
Madam Chair.
Senator Limmer.
Senator Latz, do we have anywhere else in law where we limit civil contempt to a fine? Or is this something new? Are we breaking new ground?
Chair, I do not know.
Senator Latz.
Do not know. I will note that this has to do with civil contempt only relating to failure to complete the financial disclosure where there's an attempt to collect on a judgment.
Okay. All
so right. I'm not aware one way or the other.
One other question, Madam
Senator
Chair.
Limmer.
Does your bill cover a situation where an original debtor would make a deal for a person who's owing money? Let's say they say, if you pay 50% of the balance, we'll write this off. And then only to have it 3 months, 9 months later, and the original debtor comes back and says, oh, you owe us that other $3,000. I'm hearing that that happens from constituents.
You can hear it from me right now. It's happened to me, Senator Limmer.
And does it? Does your bill cover this situation at all?
Senator Latz.
Madam Chair, Senator Limmer, I don't think it does. No.
When constituents
Senator
have asked in their situation, asked before they make that 50% payment and they scrounge up as much money as they can, oftentimes they ask who they owe. Could you put that offer in writing so at least we have a record of it? The
Senate.
People responsible will say, I'm sorry, we won't provide that until after you make your payment. And only to be, in some cases, most of them follow through and they agree to the terms. But I do know of some retailers in particular that will come back 6 or 8, 9 months saying, wanting to collect the rest of the balance. And when the consumer is asking the question, well, we made this deal. Well, do you have it in writing? And the consumer usually says, well, I requested it in writing, but I never got it. And, you know, you should have everything in writing before you transact or offer the consideration. Would that be something that could be added to your bill?
Senator Latz.
Madam Chairman, Senator Limmer, I'd be glad to work with you on that.
We'll talk.
I don't know that we can put it together
right
this hearing right now.
Okay.
Happy to work with you on a provision like that.
Senator Latz, do you have a motion?
I just want to note for the record, I have letters of support from the Minnesota Department of Commerce and from the AARP Minnesota chapter in support of this legislation. With that, I move that Senate File 33 be recommended to, as amended, be recommended to pass. And you've got in front of you where it has to go from here. I don't.
Might be buried here, but we'll find it. Senator Letts, the bill goes to the floor.
That'd be recommended to pass and refer to the floor.
All right. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Nay. Motion carries. Senator Latz's bill passes. Now my bill is
Chair.
He's voting.
I did my newsletters too.
All right, I'll take up Senate File 327. Senator Hall.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just wondering, on that last bill, was there a fiscal note on that?
No.
There's not, but it's going directly to the floor?
Yes.
Okay.
Senate File 327, Senator Goodwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. First, I'd like to offer an amendment. It's 327A-2.
That's our idea.
While we're handing that out, I'll just explain a little bit about what this amendment does.
Yeah, this is an author's amendment. So go ahead.
Yes. It was developed by the Vulnerable Adult Justice Project and representatives of the Minnesota Bar Association to respond to concerns expressed by the Minnesota Bar Association and representatives of the Minnesota Bankers Association and with the Minnesota Department of Human Services to respond to their concerns. The main differences from the bill as introduced are the ordering of the information, what is in the statute and what is in the short form, changing the effective date of the revised short form to January 1st, 2014, the removal of the damages award, and several technical amendments.
All right, does everyone have the amendment? This is an author's amendment. All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Amendment's adopted. Senator Goodwin.
Mr. Chair, now Senate File 327 proposes safeguards in the use of power of attorney documents. The misuse of these documents is a problem that is increasingly seen in the financial exploitation of the elderly and other vulnerable adults. Some of that is intentional big-ticket stealing, which is unlikely to be halted by warnings, but most of the problems are caused by people who do not understand what kind of power they are giving away and by people who do not understand what their duties are. This bill adds some speed bumps to the process without taking away the ease and accessibility of a power of attorney instrument. Leadership on this issue has come from Vulnerable Adult Justice Project. That's the source of the bill. The objectives of the bill are to clarify responsibilities, to clarify when someone with a power of attorney can make gifts to him or herself, and to allow for a judicial review when that person authorized to spend money under a power of attorney withholds an accounting of the money that was entrusted. Amy McDonough of ARP will give testimony about the background of the bill, and Laurel Garby will discuss the specific provisions. Thank you. Who wants to start?
I'm starting. Okay.
Thank you.
Go ahead, whoever's starting, and identify yourself for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Amy McDonough, and I'm the Associate State Director for Advocacy for AARP, and we want to thank Senator Goodwin for bringing this bill forward. We represent over 650,000 older Minnesotans across the state, and one of our top priorities is to protect consumers, older consumers, from elder abuse and financial exploitation. So we strongly support Senate File 327 because we believe it will help curb financial exploitation by providing more protections for Minnesotans who use a power of attorney form. We've been lucky here in Minnesota. Senator Goodwin mentioned the Vulnerable Adults Justice Project, which we're part of. This is a unique advocacy collaborative that's dedicated to improving laws and resources to protect vulnerable adults. It provides a forum for experts who work with and for vulnerable adults to weigh, debate, and ultimately advocate for policies and safeguards to better protect them. Participants in the VAJP include professionals from adult protection, public advocacy organizations, elder and disability groups, healthcare providers, law enforcement, city and county attorneys, private attorneys, and other governmental organizations. And I believe you have that long list of the VAJP in front of you. This proposal before you was initiated by members of the VAJP who are interested in increasing protections for vulnerable adults who use the power of attorney form. We believe, as Senator Goodwin said, that the power of attorney form is flexible and it's affordable. It's an important instrument for individuals and families who are planning for future incapacity. But the misuse of these documents is a growing concern for those working to prevent financial exploitation. The goal of Senate File 327 is to strengthen Minnesota law, provide some clarity to families, and help prevent the power of attorney form from becoming, quote, a license to steal. We believe the legislation does three important things. First, it provides clarity to families and individuals who use this tool by clearly stating the roles and responsibilities of the attorneys in fact. This is important because we've heard from our members that the responsibilities can be confusing. This form would now clearly state the responsibilities to the principal and ask the agent to sign and acknowledge that they understand these responsibilities. With this language, the agent would be on notice of his or her duties, and it might deter some bad conduct because the actor will not be able to claim that he or she did not know any better. It also states that the authority granted in the power of attorney is limited to financial matters and does not include healthcare decisions. And we think this is important because this misunderstanding is common. In fact, emergency responders have shared with us that from time to time a power of attorney form is shown during an emergency with the understanding or hope that it will serve as a healthcare directive. And we believe that with this new clarity, families will better understand that using a power of attorney does not also pertain to healthcare decisions. Second, this bill clarifies the limits of gifting and self-gifting and adds some cautionary language about gifting. And third, it provides a clear mechanism for people who grant this power to others to receive financial accounting and to have the court intervene if necessary. And again, this will more clearly remind agents that they must account for their handling of financial matters and be able to produce this accounting when asked. It will also help to, quote, stop the bleeding of finances sooner than what we currently see when something bad happens. This legislation certainly will not deter all bad actors who are determined to commit power of attorney abuse, but it is a strong first step towards prevention, detection, and redress, and it's a good balancing of autonomy and protection. So again, thank you, Mr. Chair, for the opportunity to testify, and we'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Are there any questions for Ms. McDonough? All right, Ms. Garb.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Laura Garvey, and for the past 6 years, I have worked as a lawyer in the field of estate planning and elder law. I'm also co-chair of the Vulnerable Adults Justice Project Working Group on the Power of Attorney, and I'm here to speak in favor of Senate File 327. Ms. McDonough has testified to the objectives of this legislation, which include clarification that the power of attorney is for financial matters only, the roles of the attorneys in fact, gifting, and the addition of a judicial relief mechanism. My testimony will focus on the substance and the process to bring this amendment, but first, I just wanted to clarify a couple terminology words. In Minnesota, we use the term principal for the person who is appointing someone else to manage finances or sign documents on his or her behalf, and we use the term attorney in fact for the person who is given the duties and authorities. The bill includes the addition of a notice to the principal as well as a notice to the attorney in fact in the statutory short form power of attorney. The notice to the principal allows the principal to understand the form they are signing. It explains the purposes and powers granted in the power of attorney form as well as the duties they are granting to an attorney in fact and how to terminate the power of attorney if needed. The information contained in the notice is not new and is information currently found in the statute. However, since most people don't read the statute and many power of attorney forms are signed without the benefit of legal counsel, the notice provides the principal information about the form he may not know or understand the extent of the powers that are included on the form. For someone who downloads the form from the internet, this is the only way this information from the statute comes. We believe informed principals can make smarter decisions regarding who to name as their attorneys in fact. The notice to the attorney in fact serves a similar purpose. The notice contains the duties an attorney in fact has to the principal once the attorney in fact uses his authority under the power of attorney form. Again, these duties are in the current statute but are not spelled out on the current form. We believe providing attorneys in fact with a list of their duties will decrease misuse of the power of attorney, especially among attorneys in fact who have no intention of utilizing their powers for the wrong reasons. The bill adds language requiring the attorney in fact to sign the form stating they have read and understood the notice. For those who misuse the power of attorney, the addition of this language will weaken a defense of not knowing or understanding their duties. The bill also clarifies that the power of attorney is to be used for financial transactions and does not give the attorney in fact the authority to make health care decisions. In the first section on the statutory short form power of attorney, line N, the word financial has been added to the powers. The bill allows the principal the option of allowing one attorney in fact the option to self-gift, but not give the same authority to a second or successor agent or attorney in fact. This allows a married individual the opportunity to name the first attorney in fact, say his spouse, the ability to gift to herself, but not allow a second or successor attorney in fact, say a child, the ability to self-gift to him or herself. The bill also changes the amount an attorney in fact is allowed to gift to her or himself. The current statute limits a self-gift up to $10,000, although this amount is not on the form. The bill proposes to change the amount of the self-gift limit to match the federal gift tax exclusion and make it clear on the form that this is the limit. It also clarifies that a gift to the attorney in fact includes a gift to anyone the attorney in fact has the legal obligation to support. Lastly, the bill includes a judicial relief mechanism allowing a principal or interested party to petition the court for an accounting when the attorney in fact fails to provide one. It also provides the principal or someone named on the power of attorney form to receive the accounting to recover attorney fees and court costs. In all, we have worked to balance the objective of protection from financial exploitation with the objective of maintaining a planning instrument that is widely available and doesn't require legal counsel or costs. As mentioned by Ms. McDonough, the Vulnerable Adults Justice Project is comprised of a wide range of professionals. In addition to these members, our working group has met with governmental agencies as well as representatives from three sections of the Minnesota State Bar Association. The amendment results from our outreach beyond VAJP. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you. Any questions for Ms. Garvey? Is there anyone from the audience wish to testify and be heard on this bill? Any questions or discussion from the committee? Seeing none, Senator Sharon moves that.
Or Senator Goodwin, maybe.
I'm sorry.
I guess Senator Goodwin wants to move her own bill.
I move that 327 be recommended to pass, and I don't think it has to go anywhere else, does it, Mr. Chair?
As amended. And it goes to the floor.
Okay. Thank you, Mr.
All those
Chair.
In favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you, Senator Limmer. Senate File 433. Turn amendment on this one.
This is really straightforward.
Good.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate File 433 is a bill that would recognize the use of photographs or digital images that are currently on our driver's licenses or identification cards in the state of Minnesota regarding an expanded use that's already given to other government agencies for the purposes of either issuing licenses for criminal justice organizations to use for identification and combating crime, for public defenders, and for child support enforcement purposes. One more opportunity to use that digital image data would be allowing a county medical examiner or coroner to also use it, not only for the purposes of identifying a decedent, but also to make a faster notice to a family or loved ones regarding the death of that individual. Oftentimes, that type of photograph could be used to quickly and positively identify an individual. Without it, there's difficulties and time begins to lapse. And we have an individual from Ann Bracey who could give us a little more information on why the request is before us. And I'd also like to point out that Hennepin County Medical Examiner has also given its support for this bill, and it should have been distributed to us earlier today.
Thank you. Ms. Bracey, welcome to the committee.
I'm Dr. Bracey. I'm employed at the Midwest Medical Examiner's Office in Anoka County. We are the appointed medical examiner for 12 counties in Minnesota. So 3,000 deaths are reported to our office each year, resulting in approximately 500 examinations in 2012. What we are asking for is that we would have access to electronic access to driver's license photographs. There are rare instances where the only photograph that we might have of an individual would be their driver's license photograph. We ask for this just so we can rapidly identify an individual. The statute, Minnesota Statute 390.25, in identification says that part of our duties are a reasonable attempts to promptly identify a deceased person. This allows us to rapidly identify family members, notify family members, and to release the body quickly to the funeral home or the cremation society so family can carry out their arrangements. Just with the things that have been in the news lately, with some of the abuses of driver's license access, we would just point out that medical examiners and coroners, by statute, are all licensed physicians. We deal with private medical data. We deal with mental health data. We deal with suicide notes. We deal with a lot of personal issues. And as physicians, these decedents are our patients. We treat all that data with respect and privacy. If someone in our office did not, they would not be employed by our office. We are aware of, we take part in data privacy training. I think we all respect this as private data, but we would just like this access to help us with families and decedents.
Thank you, Doctor. Senator Limmer, any other testimony to
offer? I'll stand for questions. Did you want to make any
comments? My only comment would be, my name is Kat Kim, and I'm an office investigator, so often this duty of locating these photographs has fallen on me. Having access would save us a lot of time, and time is money. And I'd also like to point out that we were granted access to driver's license records. The only portion we were not given access to is the photographs, which is probably our most important item that we really need in order to identify these decedents in a prompt manner.
All right. Please make sure you sign in at the witness sheet there. All right. Senator Hall.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I'd just like to say I really like this in the fact in my past life I did notifications. And there were a few times that they weren't quite sure it was the person I was going to be notifying about. And, you know, you'd go back to the department and say, I'm not notifying of a death unless I know exactly who it is and get the right person. And this would really help in that, and time is an essential part of that. So I'm really in favor of this. This is a good tool. I don't know why it hasn't been there before.
Senator Limmer, I think Senator Hall wants to be added as an author to your bill.
I do.
We can arrange that, Mr. Chair. Also, I wanted to point out that this data would fall under the same restrictions under Chapter 13.02 as the other categories of use for the same purpose.
All right, seeing no further discussion, Senator Limmer, you have a motion?
Chair, I move that Senate File 433 be recommended to pass and move to the floor. Discussion.
All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. All right, members, we are going to go into recess until 6 o'clock tonight back in this room. We're scheduled from 6 until 9. We've got an agenda of five bills that we will take up. This will help us get ahead of the curve and avoid a backlog as we get closer to first deadline and receive more referrals from other committees. Senator Ortman?
Mr. Chair, Senate File 392, is that one? I know that you're probably acting courteously by putting it last on the agenda since it's your bill, but I'm wondering if we can move it up closer to the beginning of the evening schedule.
Is there a particular
just
want to make sure you're here for?
Yeah, exactly. Mr. Chair, perhaps we could move that one to Thursday. That one we may want to take some time with, and I know given the hour, nobody's going to want to be here to take a long time about a bill like that. So I'm just wondering, it may be more controversial than you're aware. And I just wanted to make you aware of it and ask if we could take it up at a time that isn't like 8:30 at night.
Well, we Senator Ortman, we can't take it up Thursday. Our agenda is full on Thursday. And if there's some controversy over this bill, I'd sure appreciate knowing about it ahead of time. No one has contacted me to suggest they have any problems at all.
Well, Mr. Chair, I just did, frankly. I mean,
Well, maybe you and I can speak after the committee goes into recess, and we'll see if there's something that we need to readjust in terms of scheduling. Four of us on this committee are also on the Finance Committee that is meeting at 6 o'clock tonight to continue considering the health care exchange bill. So what we will be doing is we'll proceed with our committee, and when they get to the point of needing us for a vote, they know that we're here, and they will come down and tell us. And we will take a brief recess so that we can head up for our votes and then return to continue with our hearing as well. By the way, Senator Ortman, the other bills that are on the agenda for this evening anticipate are not controversial,
right.
So we may be able to move along faster than maybe you're thinking. But let's chat after we're on recess. All right, we're in recess.